removal equipment, and they'll use whatever they can to plow. Saturday night and early Sunday, forecasters say the wind and snow could lead to blizzard conditions before the storm moves out to the Atlantic. Temperatures in the Nashville area are in the teens. Frustration is mounting for some people who have been without power, we are told, for several days. From Washington, this is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing about the state of housing in America on the After the Fact podcast, available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact, and the Doris Duke Foundation.
It is a chilly morning here on the Augustana College campus, but you're just in time for a conversation with this week's guest, Jesse Lench Porter from Niobe Zoo. I'm Kai Swanson. I hope you'll join us here on WVIK for local radio as it's meant to be brewed, right here on Saturday Morning Live, portions recorded. Jesse Lench Porter, I've got to say right off the bat that in many ways you are, to me, a lot like Niobe Zoo, one of these undiscovered treasures of the Quad Cities. Now, I've known about Niobe since I was a little kid and went out there, in the 1970s on field trips. And I've gotten to know it a little bit better over the years. I got to serve, I get to serve on the Forest Reserve Commission. But what I came to find out is that the staff, the team there, they are involved in so many cool things. And I can't wait to share with people who are listening right now the many cool things you do. But before that, I don't want to get too far out over my skis. Are you originally from this area, or did we somehow attract you here?
So I'm from about 45 minutes away. I grew up around Provincetown, Illinois.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yep. Sure.
So not too far.
Like in a farm outside or a smaller town outside? Or
Actually, I grew up out in the country. Okay. So I've always been a country kid.
Well, and I love that because I've talked to a lot of people who go on to careers in the sciences who started out growing up on a farm, right? Mm-hmm. And I love Provincetown, a great park there and the bend in the river. And my old man and I used to go canoeing that stretch of the rock. It's a great town and a great landscape all the way around there. But in that kind of a setting, is that where this interest in biology, in life, and in all these kinds of things, did it begin then or did it come along later?
No, it began then. So I grew up with very random animals. Yes, my parents loved animals. They used to go to animal swap meets, believe it or not. They had things like that. I actually used to have a sheep that was leash trained, and she would go for walks with me up and down the road. And we just grew up with a whole bunch of different animals. And honestly, I wasn't going to follow this animal path. I didn't know where it would lead me. And then I changed my mind and went to college, and here I am.
Wow. Okay, I got to ask, what was the sheep's name?
It was Lily the Lamb.
Lily the Lamb. Yep. Oh, that's perfect. But so this is already very, very intriguing because I know some people who are in farming, and they may be totally focused on crop production or more traditional, like raising hogs or cattle. And yet I've had friends who get some really interesting animals because of that sort of sidelight, as long as you've got the space for them. What were some of the more interesting animals you recall your family having from those swap meets?
We had raccoons, ferrets. We had Arctic foxes.
Really?
So yeah, just some random stuff back
How
in the
do
day.
You raise Arctic foxes, I wonder?
Is that... It's not, I mean... basically like a dog.
Is it really?
Yeah. Wow. It's just a typical canid. Yep.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Very, very cool. Yeah. And I have one friend who lives out just outside of Coal Valley has really gotten into mini burros.
Oh.
Right. And I have no idea why are they not called burritos? I don't understand that. But I have to talk to a Spanish language expert on those kinds of things. Okay. So you at first thought, well, no, I'm not going to do this. What were those things that captured your interest as a young person?
You know, honestly, probably just the uniqueness of every different animal.
Okay. Yeah.
And just, you know, when you're a kid, you want to save everything and you just, I don't know, I just bonded with them for some reason. So yeah, I ended up, I was going to go to college for elementary education, believe it or not. And then I had gone to a community college for about a year and decided I need to follow my passion. So yeah, I have a bachelor's of science in wildlife ecology and management.
Wow.
So I went to University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, and I set out to do basically wildlife research.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a seasonal job while I was in college at Niobe. So while I worked at college, I came back two different summers and worked seasonal and then just absolutely fell in love with it. So I graduated and then here I am. I've been here ever since.
My goodness. Now, when you were at Stevens Point, which also has a very lovely ecology around it, mm-hmm. what were the animals there that caught your interest? Or was it more universal in terms of the study that you were doing?
Yeah, it was more universal. Yeah. They basically, I mean, I focused once I got out of the general classes on wildlife, but they introduced me to soils, forestry. Boy, what else? It was just all around, water, fisheries.
Yeah.
So all that stuff. So it definitely gave me a broad base. And then I focus more on the wildlife part of it.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, you didn't veer too far off from that elementary education because I've seen you interact with people and you're a very good educator.
Well, thank you.
You're extremely good. So thank you for that role that you fill here. But so you got a little taste of doing some of these things at Niobe. But then I know it's quite a difference when you become fully on staff. Mm-hmm. What was that transition like for you?
It was interesting because it was obviously I've been there about 21 years now. So I've seen a lot of change, a lot of growth. When I first started out, obviously growing up out in the country, I wasn't afraid of hard work. So we did a lot of, yes, we did animal care, but at that time we also did weeding and landscaping and, you know, all the not fun stuff too. We were definitely a lot more hands-on with animals then than we are now, which is good and bad. Like now we didn't train animals like we do now. So training has been a huge aspect that has grown with me throughout my career.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen so many positive benefits when mm-hmm. it comes to animal welfare overall.
Now, I would appreciate it if you wouldn't mind amplifying that a little bit, because when people hear training, they might think of something performance. But what I find fascinating is this is really about ensuring animal welfare.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about that aspect of your work.
So as far as training goes, you're absolutely right. People think training that we're training these animals to do circus tricks and different things like that. That is so far from it. So I'm actually the lead carnivore keeper. So I take care of all the big cats, painted dogs, wolves, fun stuff like that. So for the large carnivores, for example, we're all protected contact, which means we don't go in with them at all. It's a huge safety issue to be free contact with an animal like that. So they are trained simply to target, which sounds very easy. Basically, I hold up a stick in front of them and they come and put their nose on it. Well, people are like, what does that do? If an animal is injured, mm-hmm. it has a scrape mm-hmm. on it, something, mm-hmm. you have to be able to manipulate that animal in ways without going in with them to be able to see that wound on them and potentially treat that wound. Also, they do get sedation exams, so mm-hmm. we make sure mm-hmm. that they're healthy if they need x-rays, anything like that. So they're trained for hand injections. So they're trained to come up to the mesh so I can give them a shot. They're trained to open mouth so we can see their teeth, make sure their tongues. They're trained to stand up so we can see their undersides.
Mm-hmm.
So training basically is more for medical reasons and then also husbandry reasons. So if you want to see that cat outside on display, I can't go in and pick it up if it doesn't want to go outside.
Right.
So we train these animals to come inside and go outside as well.
Yeah. I thought that was so fascinating. Last summer, my spouse and I got to go to the National Zoo, and we were there at just a perfect time, and they were working with gray seals, which are big carnivores,
mm-hmm.
and you have to be very careful. But the way they were teaching them to do certain things, that they weren't tricks. They were about really getting them to show off parts of their body so they could do inspections and mm-hmm. that kind of a
yep.
thing. It's fascinating
yeah.
stuff.
Yes.
And that was something that evolved after you came to Niobe.
Oh, yes,
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah.
And it's as far as, you know, our goal is to have the best possible welfare as possible for any of the animals that we work with. And the fact that we have gone from used to have to dart animals because
mm-hmm.
we didn't yeah. have a training regimen 20 years ago is where now none of my animals have to be started. You know, they don't experience any stress whatsoever because they're trained to come up. I give them an injection and then they're asleep, just like right. us humans when we go to a doctor's office.
Or if we've ever taken our kids for, you know, shots, that kind of thing.
Right, right.
Well, so the thing that I find fascinating is the breadth of the species that are part of the Niobe collection, if you mm-hmm. will. And when I had one of your colleagues, Tammy, on the program, she said, you're not supposed to have favorites, but do you have any favorites?
You know, a lot of people ask me that. I can honestly tell you I don't have one favorite animal. It's more they all have their own different behaviors. Yeah. I can honestly say Cleo, our African leopard, mm-hmm. she's a fan favorite for a lot.
Oh, she's beautiful.
So she just turned 20 this year. So yeah. I have been with her from the day she arrived at the zoo when she was 6 months old. So I have kind of a special bond with her, I would say.
Of course. And then one of the ones that I find captivating are the palace cats,
yes.
Which are sometimes referred to as the grumpy cat. Because mm-hmm. even, it doesn't matter, they always look like they're judging you and,
yes.
and you're failing.
Yes.
But how are they to work with?
You know, honestly, they're very easy to work
Are
with.
They
want nothing to do with us for the most part. We actually have Evie. She is world famous, believe it or not.
Really?
She is. They're, if you Google Palace's cats, they have some huge following from all over the world. And there's actually some people that have made a website of specific palace cats in different zoos and where they're located. And we have someone that has basically blown her up and she's their favorite. So we have sold her paintings all over the world.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. We constantly have to keep painting with her.
Sure.
And sell her prints.
Now, yeah. you got to talk about this because one of my prized possessions, it was given to me as a birthday gift, is something that Keto had a hand in making, mm-hmm. and I display it proudly in my office. But tell listeners about this really fun program when you refer to animals painting.
Yes. So, no, none of our animals are forced to paint at all.
No.
We have come up with some pretty creative ways. So we do an animal art show every fall. And we try and have new artists every year, but we still have the fan favorite artists as well. So with Evie, it's actually during her training session. We will put paint, we'll splatter paint all over the ground, and we put canvases all over the ground. And then we will target her throughout the paint and onto the walk across the canvases. And then we have paintings.
This is fantastic. And I didn't realize she had blown up so big. I mm-hmm. hope it doesn't make her harder to work with, you know, with this ego.
Right, right. So, right. Sometimes right. I think it does.
That's fascinating. Anyway, but talking about these species, something that most people in the Quad Cities don't realize is that right here in our midst is a globally respected partner in trying to preserve certain species.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about your interaction with that work at Niobe.
So we partner with a few different conservation organizations, but the one I have been specifically involved in is paintedogresearch.org.
Mm-hmm.
So make sure that you check that out. I was able to, this November, I went over to Zimbabwe, Africa for 2 weeks, and I was able to study African painted dogs. It was a very awesome experience, and Niobe Zoo has done a huge contribution. And honestly, not necessarily financially
right.
that we contribute
right.
to this
right.
organization. We, our resources and our time and the training that we help with their staff that then helps do their research out in the wild is mainly what Niobe is involved in. And I can't say enough, one of the things that I learned over there and saw firsthand is the fact that there's so many people think that all conservation organizations want is your
right.
monetary donation. They want some kind of financial donation. That's not it. There's a lot of conservation organizations that if you're a grant writer, if you're even an educator, there's different things like that, that there's different roles that you can help in conservation as well, not just from the monetary standpoint.
Sure. We do want to give credit where it's due because I believe that the trip was supported by people who support the Niobe Zoo Foundation.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
Which is a fantastic
way. Yeah, and I can't thank the Niobe Zoo Foundation enough. They
do such great work.
Oh, and they solely support the staff as well for different education classes and things like that. A lot of people don't realize it, but you know, us as zookeepers, we have continuing education as well. We're constantly learning. Our field is constantly changing. There's different conferences, and the foundation has been huge in supporting us on that.
Well, and then before we get to your logistics, because I can't wait to hear about your trip to Zimbabwe, but I find it fascinating that so much of this is based on these professional slash personal relationships that evolve. So here at Niobe, we have a great naturalist named Joel Vanderbush, who gets to know a great naturalist who's based in Zimbabwe, Greg Rasmussen, correct?
Yep, correct.
And so somehow or another, they connect, and then their research interests sort of overlap, and that's kind of how we got connected to Zimbabwe, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. But this was your first time going over there.
Yes, first time.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Well, let's get into this a little bit. First off, how on earth do you get from Coal Valley to Sizinda, Zimbabwe? How do you fly there? I mean, that's even that basic.
I was in the air, I think, on the way over there. I was in the air for like 18 hours. And then on the way home with my layovers, it was like 23 hours. So I literally flew from Chicago to Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, and then to Zimbabwe.
But did you go to Harare or did you?
No.
To Bulawayo?
No.
How did you fly into Zimbabwe? I don't even know where the airports would be.
It's in Victoria Falls.
Oh, Victoria Falls.
Yes.
Oh, cause,
yes.
Yeah, sure,
yes.
Because that's a lot of people want to come from around the world to visit there. Okay, so you get there, and then...
Yes, and then it was culture shock, definitely from the time I got off the airplane. I had gone on the trip telling myself I needed to be completely open-minded. It was going to be a completely different experience than I've ever done. So... I went with Joel Vanderbush. So luckily he was with me because he helped calm my nerves a few different times. So we literally, Greg and one of his staff members, Zulu, came to pick us up at the airport. And here's an old red field truck. So I literally rode in the back of the field truck to Greg's house, which is about 30 minutes from the airport. Obviously, we don't really ride in the back of pickup trucks in the U.S. anymore. So we did that in Zulu. So Greg and Zulu both speak very good English. Zulu, however, has a pretty heavy accent. And as most of you know, the more that you're around someone with a heavy accent, the better you understand them, I should say. So I'm in the back of the truck with Zulu, which I did meet a handful of years ago. He had come to the U.S. on one of Greg's tours. And so I'm in the back of the truck riding down. There's one paved road, and then we have to ride about, I'd say, 15 minutes or so down a dirt road, which is so bumpy that you have to go back and forth on all sides of the road just to avoid all the major ruts and everything. So, you know, Zulu's talking to me. I can hardly understand what he's saying because I'm not used to being around his heavy accent yet. So it was quite an experience for me just from the start.
Well, I'm sure you navigated it very well, but I know what you're talking about. In fact, I'll make a confession to you right now. When I was about 19 years old, I got to go to a global youth conference that was held in Hungary, and my roommate was a wonderful guy from Malawi. And I was struggling to understand him. I'm sure he was struggling to understand me, but I made the cardinal mistake of saying, well, what is your first language? And he said, well, it's English. So I was an idiot. I've learned maybe something, not much, but I've learned a couple of things since being 19, but I'll never forget that was something. But so, okay, so you get to the site, and I think when people think about interacting with wildlife in sub-Saharan Africa, they have an image of grand lodges and beautiful verandas and all this kind of thing. Describe to us as it was unfolding for you, your accommodations.
Yes. So just on the village drive to Sizinda. So I technically stay in the village of Sizinda, is where Greg's property is located. On the way there, like I said, the dirt road, anywhere from little huts. I don't even know if I would consider any of the homes that I saw anything that you would see here in the U.S. People everywhere walking barefoot, different things. Even I have to say there was donkeys and goats and cows free ranging mm-hmm, along the road. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And mind you, when I went, I have to preface with, I went at the very end of the dry season.
Yeah.
So if you think about it, going at the end of the dry season, the livestock that I saw, there's a lot of communal ground, which mm-hmm. means it can freely range. It doesn't have to stay on their property. It was very, very thin. And for me being a zookeeper, that's one thing that, okay, we are very aware of body condition. We have to make sure it's certain grades to make sure their body condition is where it's supposed to be. So I'm seeing these extremely thin animals. And so that was definitely eye-opening. And the fact of I had asked once I arrived at Greg's, mm-hmm. do they not supplemental feed? Here in the U.S., we feed hay and things like that to our hoofstock animals. They don't. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's survival of the fittest over there. Mm-hmm. So as long as they can make it through the dry season, then they'll have plenty to eat during the wet season. So that was a little eye-opening as well. And then to pull up to Greg's house, it's all there's a fence all the way around it. And then I was shown what my housing would be, which is what you call a rondavel, which just specifically means a round house. So mind you, over there, which we'll probably get a little bit more into it, the water that they use is only what they collect during the wet season. So there's no flushing toilets. Mm-hmm. There is really no showers. You do have water, some spigots to use, but you collect your water and things to reuse. And there's lizards everywhere, mm-hmm. Spiders, insects, you name it. It was very eye-opening.
I know that you are a very courageous person. And like you said, you are very open-minded about this. But did it take some adjustment?
It absolutely did. It did for the fact of, I can't even know really how to describe it. Yeah. Just being it was almost like kind of like an out-of-body experience, if that makes sense. Yeah. Because everyone around you, yes, they're speaking English, but in the very beginning, I can't really understand them. I'm meeting all these new people, and obviously a white woman sticks out like a sore thumb over in the part of Africa I was in. So it was definitely a culture shock.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
And even everything's open air. So there's no screens on the windows. Yes, there's windows, but they're open. All the homes leave their doors wide open. It's just, it's a total different way of living.
Well, and as a researcher, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I would take for granted that I'm going to charge up my devices and I'm going to use them as I want and grab electricity whenever I want. But it wasn't that way for you. Tell us about how you were able to adjust your research schedule around the availability of, say, electricity.
Yeah. So Greg's property is only solely run on solar. And with that being, I then came in the very beginning of the wet season and it rained every day that I was there. So obviously solar needs sunlight to charge. So there was days that we had power for maybe 2 hours of day, 2 hours out of the day. So before we would leave to go for the day to do some of the field work, we made sure all of our devices were plugged in that could be plugged in. So that way, if the power did turn on, we got charged as much as possible. Even the Wi-Fi. So Greg's house, and then there was a little area right next to it, was the only place that we had Wi-Fi, and you only had Wi-Fi for those, the time that you had power.
Right.
And even, I do have to say, though, here we lose power and everybody panics. Over there, it's just a relaxed situation. It's just an everyday thing. Like, it's okay, we don't have power. It's not a big deal. So Joel had warned me, though. I did bring a headlamp with me. Mm-hmm. And then I did buy a bigger battery power pack to keep that charged as well. So I always had my headlamp at night if I needed it. Mm-hmm. Just different things like that we take for granted over here.
Yeah. But there was great resourcefulness, too, because when you and I should disclose that you made a wonderful presentation to the Rock Island County Forest Reserve Commission, but you were able to share a photo. And I wish we could do that. But radio has good pictures, too. Right. The vehicle that you used was basically a solar charging station.
So
it had those collector panels all over it.
When we went out to do field work, we were changing camera traps and every camera track trap, if I remember correctly, took 6 batteries. So on the dash of this field truck, all you see is AA batteries lined up. And they, so on the side of the field truck was big solar panels. So literally as we were taking the batteries out of the camera traps, we were putting them right onto the charger. So then the solar panels were charging the batteries.
Amazing.
It's a different way of life, but they know how to do it.
Yeah. Well, I want to remind folks that my guest this week is Jesse Lench Porter, a zookeeper at the Niobe Zoo and also a global researcher. And we're going to continue with that conversation here. So when you mentioned camera traps, tell us a little bit about the role that those play and also about how they tend to invite some vandalism.
Yes. So this was probably the most interesting part of my trip is everyone thinks hunters around this area use camera traps to see the location and what animals are coming across. So it's very similar to what hunters do here in the U.S., except obviously we're not hunting over here. We collected over 70 camera traps. And when we collect the data cards off the camera traps, there's hundreds and thousands of pictures that they have to go through. So they would go through, obviously I was studying African painted dogs. So the goal was to see where the dogs were at. However, we saw giraffe, we saw African crested porcupine, so many species we saw as well. And I do have to say that with Greg's research, it's very all encompassing. Mm-hmm. So as we were collecting this data, he would save the giraffe research. Right. He would save all the different species that we were doing so other organizations can use that data as well. But as far as unexpected visitors, one of the parks that we were collecting traps in is highly populated with elephants. Mm. So they can't just hang a trap on a tree. They will find it ripped off the tree and shattered in pieces. So they have to make elephant boxes that are literally 6 foot in the ground, concreted, a metal box, the camera trap sticks out it, and then there's even metal, basically prongs on the top of it so they don't want to touch mm-hmm. it with their mm-hmm. trunks to mm-hmm. rip it out of the ground. Mm-hmm. So that was it. And another thing with the camera traps is any vehicles that are caught on those camera traps are also sent to law enforcement mm-hmm. so they know who's in the parks and who's supposed to be. And then we did collect traps on private land as well one of the days, and two of the traps were actually cut off the trees because people weren't supposed to be on the grounds. And if they see the camera traps, they would cut them because they knew they'd get caught.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the camera traps serve multiple purposes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you made a reference to this. There, you have these national parks. I think one that you, was it Hwangae that you worked in?
Panda Masui.
Yep. But then there are these private lands mm-hmm. and there's a sea of difference that you talked about between these two environments in, mm-hmm. in part reasons of protection, but also in part reasons of exploitation, some that are set aside for people who do want to hunt and or people who just want to come on a photo safari. Talk about how that has impacted, especially the elephant. You made reference to the elephant population.
Yeah.
How that differentiates.
So I got two different experiences. When we did our field research, we were in the Panda Masui Park, which isn't a high tourist park. So anytime that we saw any wildlife, they just ran because they're not used to having vehicles all over. I shouldn't say it's not as highly tourist park. And then on the private land as well, of course, anytime we saw animals, they were gone. And when we went in the private land, we were actually pulling the cameras. And that's one thing I want to note is I had no idea the difference that the landscape would be between the dry and the wet season.
Mm.
So when we were on the private land, we pulled the cameras because there's no way they could get to the cameras during the wet season. There was actually an area we drove through that would be a beautiful waterfall if it was in the wet season. It was completely bone dry. Mm. So you don't even think about the difference in the landscapings just from one season to the next. I mean, yes, we have it a little bit here around the Midwest, but not to the extremes they do over there.
Have you ever seen those Attenborough documentaries of life on Earth? They sort of time lapse when all of a sudden everything blooms.
Yeah.
And it's just that quick.
Yeah. And then my other experience, Greg actually took us out on game drive is what he called it. And that was in Zambezi National Park, mm-hmm. which is a very tourist prevalent park. And that, honestly, we would drive through and stop, and the elephants surrounded our truck, and it was no big deal. However, when we were doing our research in Panda Missouri, we had to actually stop and back up when we saw elephants because they're not used to seeing the vehicles. So we had to make sure that they went clear away before we finished driving through. So definitely a big difference. And I can see why people come over from the tourist aspect, but it was really cool to be able to just see animals in their natural habitat as well, not being affected by tourists.
Right. So you mentioned that Greg and the team at painteddogsresearch.org are constantly working and saving information on all manner of species. But again, you went there for painted dogs. What is our connection with painted dogs?
So our connection with Painted Dogs is we do Painted Dog Research USA. Mm-hmm. So we are the United States-based research foundation for Painted Dog Zimbabwe.
And if you go to Niobe, you get a chance to see.
Yes. So that is one thing a lot of people are like, well, you went over to see painted dogs. And I can honestly tell you, I didn't see a single painted dog while I was there.
Yeah.
They're very elusive, but that's part of research. That's part of conservation. Every day you're not going to see the animal that you're trying to learn about. My role here at Niobe is I take care of the African painted dogs. So what we want to do at Niobe is we want you to come and see the painted dogs. And to see a painted dog right in front of you, real life, that's way more impressive than you just Google searching it and seeing it online.
Sure.
So we want to be able to form a connection and a relationship with the visitors that come to our zoo and educate them enough to hopefully they will turn around and help their counterparts in the wild.
Yeah.
We're their help.
Yeah.
Without us, they wouldn't be here.
And I want to talk with you about that because I see it happen. I take grandkids out there and they love some of the animals that they now know by name. Mm-hmm. But there's something different about actually getting that close to an Amur leopard, a snow leopard, a painted dog. And it sets something off. And I hope that that's assisting their parents in raising global citizens, right? People who are aware of environmental health. And that's a big part of what you do.
Yeah, and that was one thing over in Zimbabwe that Joel and I helped with is Greg's facility hosts bush camps. So, and these bush camps are for school-age children. Mm-hmm. And the camp that I also got to help with, they were 14-year-old girls and boys. And they've never seen a zoo. So there's not the zoos that are prevalent like there is here in the States. So I did a presentation for them and I specifically had different enrichment pictures of things that we do with our painted dogs. They were so excited. Like they couldn't grasp the concept. Yes, they have probably seen it on TV or different things, if that. But to be able to teach them and basically let it sink in with them that they're not alone in trying to do this research and trying to save the African painted dogs, that we're their support. Like, we are here and this is what we do over here to help you and to try and connect the two different types.
Now, you didn't get to see painted dogs.
No.
But what is the purpose of that research? I remember when Greg Rasmussen came here to the Quad Cities, and it's great to have these amazing naturalists from all over the world who come here because Niobe has people like you and Joel and Tammy and Lee and so on and so forth. But he told something that I just has really stuck with me. And, you know, we ascribe to canids certain traits like loyalty and concern for their group, their pack or whatever it may be. But when he shared the story about how there was one member of a pack that he was tracking who was injured in a hunting, a successful hunt, I think, but this one animal was injured and it had disappeared for a while. And then they finally deduced that another younger, healthier member of the pack was sneaking food out to this one while it recuperated. I mean, it's a fascinating thing to think about.
Yes.
And Yeah.
Well, and I learned so much just from talking to Greg and the knowledge he has for as long as he has researched these dogs. For example, there was a pack, I believe it was 10 dogs. But anyway, so They had, mom had pups. I'll just kind of simplify it.
Sure.
Mom had pups, and then they had yearlings, and then they had the alpha male. And the alpha male is the one that was going out hunting. Well, the yearlings hadn't learned how to hunt yet. And this male went missing for 2 to 3 days.
Oh, my.
And this whole time, you know, Greg is seeing this. Well, unfortunately, all of the rest of the family is going to die if this one doesn't show up.
Right.
So it's, he did show up. He ended up coming back. I think he was gone for 4 or 5 days. Don't quote me on it, but it was right around that time.
Yeah.
And everything was fine. But no one truly understands like the pack hierarchy and stuff. And the success rate, painted dogs are one of the highest successful hunters out of every species that hunts. But it has to be the right generation that's trained to hunt. So there's so many variables. And the reason Greg does what he does is because humans interrupt that.
Yeah.
So if, for example, that male would have been killed, look at the effect.
Sure.
You know, the
sure.
waterfall effect. And,
sure.
So Greg's done some amazing research.
Well, we're going to get more into that phenomenon of human interruption of processes in just a moment, but I'm going to interrupt what's been a wonderful conversation with Jesse Lench Porter from Niobe Zoo, because friends, this is that time every week on Saturday Morning Live, Portions Recorded, when we get a chance to check in with another wonderful researcher, but of human behavior, and that is Rock Island Lines with Dr. Roald Tweet.
This is Roald Tweet on Rock Island. No Rock Islander has ever searched for the Holy Grail, or climbed a beanstalk, or chased strange women with a glass slipper. We have work to do. From Betsy Ross to Paul Bunyan, Casey Jones, the cowboy, and our own Mike Fink, king of the keelboatmen, Americans have become heroes because of their work, not in their leisure after hours. I learned this several years ago by hitching a ride on the Julia Bell Swain, a brand new sternwheeler with a real steam engine built just upriver at Dubuque. We came down the river on its maiden voyage, bound for the Illinois River tourist trade, while carpenters and electricians worked at the finishing touches. At the wheel, in the pilot house, was 78-year-old Roy Boyd of Rock Island, the only river pilot still licensed for steamboats. For this license, he had had to learn by heart the entire Upper Mississippi and draw it on paper from memory. Here was a man who knew where he was going. He was all business. The channel twisted from shore to shore, close to Iowa, now to Illinois, and Roy had to pay attention all the time. But business was beautiful, too. Roy had been retired for many years, and now he was back on the river he loved, hands steady on the wheel, responsible for $1 million of boat. I spent the late hours of the night in the pilot house. The windows were open, the better to see. The temperature was in the low 30s, and it was cold and crisp. It was quiet except for the steam pistons pushing in and out 15 times a minute. We heard people talking on shore. Now and then a searchlight came on to spot a buoy and keep us in the channel. Sometimes forms of geese and ducks flew across the darkness into the light. Roy Boyd talked back and forth with men in passing barges by short wave. It was business talk, but it was also men talking to each other in the dead of night. Beautiful business. I came to see that on the river, at least, work and romance, time clocks and heroes still mix. I hope they do where you live.
Rock Island Lines with Roald Tweet is underwritten by Augustana College, Rock Island, Illinois.
And Rock Island Lines is something you can count on hearing on WVIK every Saturday morning, because WVIK has been able to count on you. If you'd like to support local programming for our local community, you can pop over to WVIK.org. And trust me, my colleagues on the staff make it very easy to find the donate button, nice and big up in the upper right-hand corner. My guest this week is Jesse Lench Porter, who's a zookeeper at Niobe Zoo, who's recently returned from an amazing research experience in Zimbabwe. And one of the things I found fascinating is elephants. It's a multifaceted story depending on where in the world you are. And they might face challenges in one part of Africa, same species generally, that they do not face in another part of Africa, but it's kind of in sharp focus in Zimbabwe. Tell us a little bit about that.
So that was one thing that was very eye-opening to me as we were going through the different game drives and just even the field research that we were doing. The landscape is completely devastated, just wiped out. And, you know, like I've said before, I went at the end of the dry season, so that makes a difference, some of it. But, I mean, you're talking the trees are all topped off at maybe 6 foot. Like, basically, you can tell the elephants have just come through. Great, right? You get to see all these elephants. I mean, yes, that's exciting. However, there has been an addition of artificial water holes. And the purpose of artificial water holes is to draw the wildlife to those water holes so the tourists can have a great experience and see all these animals. It's definitely a good and bad scenario because obviously over in Africa, they rely on the tourist dollars. Understandable, completely understandable. However, that has totally had a domino effect when it comes to affecting wildlife. So because the artificial water holes have been created, elephants no longer have to travel to find water sources. And as they were traveling, that meant that they spent all their resources basically going to the different water holes to find water throughout the dry season. Well, now that they don't have to waste that much time and energy doing that, they're breeding all year round.
Yeah.
And typically, elephants wouldn't breed during the dry season. So it has increased the elephant population by thousands. And people think, well, how is that a big deal? The landscape is showing you. So if you think about it, if there's an area that's completely decimated from elephants, that's going to affect all of your hoof animals. So ones that are eating the trees, the leaves and stuff off the ground, their food isn't going to be as prevalent. And then it's going to affect the prey species because the prey species are going to have to look in different areas to find the hoofstock animals. Mm-hmm. And even Greg Rasmussen also wrote a paper on this. I will have to get the title of that paper. He basically analyzed the soil compaction, everything, and he took other researchers that have done different parts of it, and he put it all together with his own research on how it affects everything. And from the landscaping being completely torn away, even from a hunting strategy, it affects the strategy of hunting for different prey-predator relationship. So people don't understand the domino effects that it has. Yes, it's awesome to see that many elephants, but it's not going to be good.
Yeah. And it's such a delicate balance. It's been worked out basically by time and evolution to think that there's supposed to be a dry season, and that's supposed to tell the elephants now is not the time for gestation, right?
Yes, yes.
And you just mess with that a little bit. And so you had shared that the government of Zimbabwe or other naturalists have determined what an ideal population size would be versus what it really is. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the elephant population used to be anywhere from like 4,000 to 6,000. Again, don't quote me on the specific exact numbers. And then now it's like 30,000 to 40,000.
Oh, wow.
So
on the
alone,
one hand, you're excited because I'm old enough to remember when the ivory trade was such a big deal and we were so worried about, you know, elephants, but it's just as bad on the opposite.
Yeah. And, you know, unfortunately, it's a matter of to decrease that population. You know, they've talked about culling elephants. Even if they start to decrease the water holes, you're talking about more deaths then. That's going to affect the tourists because no one wants to see an elephant that's like that. And even just disposal wise, I mean, it's just, and no one wants to do that to elephants. That I honestly think was probably one of the most eye-opening experiences I had overall because I love elephants. I used to work with the elephants at Nairobi years ago. So they're close to my heart. But to see the devastation that it's happening and how it's affecting all the different species below it, even the vegetation, how it's affecting it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's definitely hard to see.
Well, but I want to tie that into the work that you do day in and day out at NIAABI with your colleagues, because it has evolved so much in my lifetime.
Oh, yes.
When I was a kid, I mean, in retrospect, I didn't realize it, but people have described it as a glorified petting zoo and a hobby sort of a thing, and that's all well and good. But as we learn more and we pivot more towards the well-being of the animals, mm-hmm. and I really think you and your colleagues have, that is the primary focus. And
oh,
it
absolutely
changes the way you manage and administrate a zoo, mm-hmm. right? And I'm grateful for it. But this notion, I now describe it as a conservation education center, which mm-hmm. is really what it is, right? But how do we not only teach our young people as they become citizens to be aware of their role in the environment, but to think that generation or two downstream, right? And I don't know what the secret is for that, because things that I learned that were environmentally responsible 30 years ago, I now realize are not, mm-hmm. right? How does that come into your role as an educator?
So a lot of things that we do, especially with our zookeeper chats and things that we offer, I often say the phrase that knowledge is power. So the more knowledge, the more that we can teach here at the zoo, it's just going to trickle on. And like, that's why we do the camps. So if you think about it, the kids come to the camps. The kids they learn a lot. They get super excited about it. What do your kids do when they come home? The first thing they do is tell mom and dad what they learned at camp.
Mm-hmm.
So you're hoping inadvertently you're setting that precedent. You're educating them. So hopefully, even if it's just one little thing, one thing that I stress in a lot of my keeper chats is the FSA, FSC, sorry, Forest Stewardship Council. So it's literally a tree with a check mark. And you can find a Kleenex box. You can find paper products. So what that tree with a checkbox means is those paper products came from a renewable source, a renewable forest. So if we can do one little thing and it sticks, that's better than nothing.
Right. I mean, and that's a label that appears,
yes,
right,
it's
on
a
the
label.
Product.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
And I show that label to the kids, you know, because kids see that. And when you see something like that, you're going to relate more to it than me just telling you like I am right now.
Yeah.
But I think that's one major role that NIAABI has, is we're constantly trying to educate any chance that we get. That's why we do our programs. That's why we bring in camp kids. That's why we do zookeeper chats. Knowledge is power. The more that we can educate the generation now.
Sure.
Hopefully it jumps up a little, but then hopefully it goes down too.
Well, it's easy to misplace on a very cold January Saturday like we're here visiting on, but it will soon be time for the zoo to reopen. And I can tell you, again, having brought grandkids to different things at the zoo, it's a wonderful thing to do for little people in your life. But people can already start making those plans right now, right?
Absolutely.
What is that NIAABI website?
Right? NIAABI, yeah. So you can go to NIAABIZOO.com, and we have a whole bunch of different links that you can click on, and it's plan your trip, you know, and there's so many exciting things that are coming that are new. We did get a big grant, and this grant, we are going to have a new dinosaur dig area, and that's going to be located right by the playground.
Mm-hmm.
We're also going to be putting in a splash pad this summer. That's going to be located between the carousel and the new cat house building that we have. And then we're also adding on a deck that's going to overlook the ravine outside by our education area, so that way we can host different events and stuff as well on that deck. So the big thing with NIAABI is, it's a great small zoo. You can get through it within a couple hours with your kids, let them burn some energy, lots of animals to see. But adding these newer attractions, we are so solely focused on animal welfare and their diet and nutrition. And so we kind of got that down. To say, we can always learn, don't get me wrong, but we have an animal nutritionist that comes and analyzes our diets, enrichment program. We have a training program. So we decided that to apply for this grant, that let's add a little bit more things for the public to be able to experience, so they can see animals or they can just come and play the splash pad for the day. Be outside. You know, that's the big thing, is just be outside, be in nature, get some fresh air, and just come and enjoy the zoo.
It's a wonderful investment by the state of Illinois. The program is called OSLAD, and I'll probably get this wrong, but I think it's Open Spaces Land Acquisition and Development, I think, because I've actually gone to Springfield to beg for that money.
I was going to say, I would not have known that, but good job.
I've done that in the past because it's important for our community.
And I guess I'm going to interrupt you, too. Yeah. Another thing is we have decided to do every third Thursday of the month from May through September, we're going to have extended hours.
You can always interrupt me with stuff like that, Jesse.
Yeah, we're just excited. There's a lot of new changes coming. And after we had our snow apocalypse, yes, is what we called, we finally have all that construction done. Everything's open as, whenever we open for the season. We ended on a really good note last season. So this season, we've got a lot of new stuff coming again. But it's going to be huge.
Well, and it's really quite serious. And I think it illustrates a lot about what we've been talking about. Is part of the reason that snowpocalypse affected Niobe so badly is that a lot of those structures that were most affected were built without a lot of specialization in terms of, and I think it really, I put it down to you and the team and the leadership at Niobe. If you put animal welfare first, then it's okay to not save $5,000 by having somebody build something that they don't know how to build a zoo thing, right?
Yep.
So
yep,
you pay a little more for the expertise. You get a better space for the animals. One of my favorites is the fennec foxes. We had them for years, and they weren't really thriving, at least by the sign of procreation. And now, my goodness, stop playing Barry White. We keep having a new litter of fennec foxes.
Well, we are actually the number one breeding facility for zoos in the U.S.
Are we really?
Yes. Yep.
Oh,
we are
on.
Known for our fennec fox breeding.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Of course. And they're so adorable. Oh. I mean, come on. And then I will say, you didn't ask, but I do have one who's my favorite now.
Oh, okay.
And it's actually two ladies, Tina and Louise.
Oh,
small-footed Asian otters are so much fun. Oh. And if you haven't seen them, you got to get out and see them. And so I don't want to bury that lead, though. This is really cool that the zoo leadership has decided as a pilot process to see if we can sustain evening hours on a pilot basis. And friends, if you think that's a good idea to be able to take your kids out on a weeknight, by all means, go. So that'll tell the leadership that we need to do more of that. All right, we're going to run out of time, and I'm so sorry about that. But one thing I always like to put my guests on the spot with, are you reading something or have you recently read something that is really interesting, nonfiction, fiction, anything in between that you'd care to recommend to us? Or seen a movie or watched streaming a
series?
I'll
be honest with you. I have two teenage girls that are in gymnastics, basketball, and volleyball.
Unfair question.
Yeah.
Totally
nope.
Unfair question.
I don't even, the TV doesn't even get turned on most evenings, to be honest with you.
Well, and I did, in the time we have remaining, I was wondering if you wouldn't mind telling us, that's got to be, you got a couple of teenagers, and then you had this opportunity to go all the way around the world and live in places where I don't think any teenager or any teenage version of me would have lived.
Mm-hmm.
What did they think of Ma going off and doing that?
So it's funny that you say that. I had to do a presentation for the zoo, actually. And I actually started that with a letter that my 16-year-old daughter had written me before I left, basically, saying how proud she was and the examples that I was setting, and basically telling me to go do big things. And, that is a working mom and being a zookeeper, working on Christmas Day and things like that, that told me I was doing things right. So they were really proud of me. My husband, I can't thank him enough, was extremely supportive as well. Made sure I had all the gear and everything I needed before I went. So my girls and my husband, thank them. They were a huge support on this and always have been in my zoo career. Yeah, I do have a little funny story. I'll be quick.
Yeah.
I took a picture of the outhouse area that I had, and I did have that in a slideshow for the county presentation, but I sent it to both of my daughters, and the one just laughed at it, and the other one was like, are you serious? So, definitely not an experience they will probably want, my husband either, but I absolutely loved it. And again, I can't thank the foundation enough for supporting my trip, and then also paineddogresearch.org for giving me the opportunity to have the actual field work.
Well, let me just echo something. You're doing a lot of things right. So thank you for being part of our community and for coming here and coming in out of the cold for a little bit of time to share with us Painted Dogs. And again, in addition to the Painted Dogs Research niobezoo.org. Go to niobezoo.com and plan your next visit, and we hope we'll see you out there. But for now, that's going to have to do it for this week. Thank you to my guest, Jesse Lynch Porter, for being with us. And ahead on WVIK, it's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Be sure to join us next week when my guest will be Emily Nash from the Quad City Symphony Orchestra. That's right here on Saturday Morning Live, portions recorded. You can find our podcast at WVIK.org or just tune in to Quad City's NPR WVIK 90.3 FM and HD in Rock Island, 95.9 FM K240 DZ Dubuque.